Simon & Schuster Audio presents Tom Clancy's Op Center, War of Eagles. Created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachinik, and written by Jeff Roven. Read by Adam Grupper.
Charleston, South Carolina. Monday, 4:57 a.m. When Jesse Weedles was a young man stationed at the Charleston Naval Base, he had a very precise and accurate job description. The Athens, Georgia native was Chief Mess Management Specialist. He was proud of that position. More than just a cook, Weedles was a craftsman. His job was to make certain that when someone sat down in his mess hall, whatever their rating, he or she had the best soup, hottest entree, and finest cookies and coffee in the United States Navy. Weedles wondered what life would have been like had he stayed with the Navy. After his hitch, he took over the family restaurant, a roadside diner that was struggling to survive in the face of fast food. They hung on 10 years, after which his dad sold the property, divided the profit among his three sons, and called it a day. Weedles lost his share of the $90,000 in an internet startup. Now both the former mess chief and the naval base were doing something else. The base had been there for nearly 95 years when it was shut down in 1996 as part of the Base Realignment and Closure Program. There was concern at the time that the loss of the fleet and 4,000 support jobs would kill the harbor and drag Charleston with it. But federal agencies and commercial enterprises sailed to the rescue, filling the base with tenants and barely causing a skipped beat in the economic pulse of the city. The redevelopment project even saved the struggling career of 37-year-old Jesse Weedles. He got a job as the morning manager of Teddy R's, a new waterfront restaurant that catered to freighter and tanker crews, arriving or departing in the early morning tide. It was a great position, because he got to do something he enjoyed and was good at, and he loved arriving before sunup to turn on the grill and get the deep fryer bubbling. Unlike the Navy, the men who came to his restaurant were multicultural. They looked, spoke, and even smelled different. He welcomed the opportunity to experience a little bit of Bulgaria or Hong Kong, of Venezuela or Great Britain right on his doorstep. Weedles was also delighted by the fact that when he left work at 2 p.m, there was still warm daylight to enjoy with his wife and young twins. There was just one thing Weedles had never anticipated, that one day a freighter might explode in the pre-dawn blackness, destroying a significant section of the dock, Teddy R's, and ending his life. Charleston, South Carolina. Monday, 5:01 a.m. Charleston PD Harbor Patrol Sergeant Al Graff had the wheel of his small white patrol boat. His partner, Officer Randy Molina, was in the well. He was scanning the mouth of the Ashley River with night vision goggles, watching for small vessels. Over the past few months, drug dealers from the Caribbean had been making drops along the southeastern seaboard, meeting local distributors who brought the narcotics to shore in rowboats. It was a warm morning with a soft westerly wind. The 8-year veteran was about to turn back toward the mainland when something exploded a half mile behind them. Both men turned. The blast lit the historic waterfront rooftops and the ornate spire of St. Philip's. The rolling cloud itself blew much higher, spawning a spray of yellow and magnesium-white tendrils. They tumbled to earth, tracing hot, jagged paths in the sky. Within moments, the surface shock wave of the blast had reached the boat, causing ripples that heaved the small vessel violently from side to side. While Molina simultaneously radioed the Coast Guard and the CPD HP dispatcher for assistance, Graff swung the patrol boat toward the rising crimson cloud. It was obvious that a freighter had exploded. Graff could see the outline of the hull against the flames. The vessel was spilling oil into the harbor, which fueled the fire. A pair of CPD HP helicopters arrived within minutes to drop fire retardant foam around the outside perimeter of the blaze to form a floating barricade that would keep it from reaching other ships. Big canvas hoses were rushed over by the harbor master's dock crew to keep embers from igniting buildings or wooden structures on neighboring vessels. It appeared that only two structures had been damaged on the waterfront, the Southern Bells Music Shop and Teddy R's. Trucks from the Charleston Fire Department arrived just a few minutes later, to help hose down the remaining structures and to mount an immediate search and rescue for survivors in the freighter or in the two burning buildings. The joint CPD-CFD Anti-Terrorist Task Force was next on the scene. While specialists from Fire Station 3 used their mobile hazmat lab to test for signs of radiological, bacteriological, or chemical agents, their CPD counterparts rushed to secure and search other vessels. The highway patrol blocked roads around the sector to keep perpetrators from escaping, while spotters directed patrolmen to buildings that had a direct line of sight with the afflicted vessel. If this was a rocket-propelled grenade, they might be in time to stop the attacker from leaving. It was a slick, tightly coordinated operation that had been rehearsed numerous times. Everyone knew exactly what to do, and they did it with unflinching courage. Graf and Molina had two jobs: to watch the coast to make sure this wasn't a distraction created by smugglers, and to search for anyone who may have survived the explosion. A quick circuit of the blast perimeter did not produce any survivors. It did produce body parts, however, limbs with charred skin and remarkably clean, unblemished white bone bobbing on the choppy river. There were pieces of clothing that did not sink with the rest of the ship, and tangled mats of hair and fresh blood. Graf was not equipped to retrieve the evidence, but he did photograph it. The pictures, taken with a Satlink digital camera, were automatically sent to the CHP and to the FBI Field Division in Columbia and to Bureau Headquarters in Washington, D.C. There, the images would be compared to a database of shipyard attacks to look for similarities. Graf documented the scene unemotionally. He did not know who these people were or what they were doing on the vessel or dock. He did not know which of them had families. Since terrorism had become a daily possibility on every American calendar, Graf's default setting was to protect the harbor, the city, and the nation. He was emotionless about his work, but passionate about his responsibility. Molina informed him that the scoop sloop would be there within a quarter hour. That was the patrol boat with the nets and freezers required for evidence recovery. Graf stood on the prow and continued to take pictures. As they neared the hold in the vessel, Graf saw something that punched through his professional detachment. Something that put the nature of the vessel, if not the explosion, in context. He saw a little bead bracelet floating on the choppy waters, with a little girl's hand still attached. Washington, D.C., Monday, 7:33 a.m. The call came as a surprise to Paul Hood. He was just sitting down with a cup of coffee and a power bar when his assistant put through Lorraine Sanders, Chief of Staff to President Dan Devenport. The 46-year-old Director of Op Center was being asked to breakfast in the Oval Office at the White House. He ate the power bar anyway. The china at the White House was Jacksonian, old and delicate, and the less he used, the happier he was. This was obviously not a crisis. That was not something a new president discussed over bran muffins. It was also not a social visit, since those invitations typically came with more than 90 minutes advance notice. It was certainly not a get-to-know-you meeting, because Hood knew Devenport well. The senator had been chairman of the Congressional Intelligence Oversight Committee, the group that controlled the budget of Op Center. Maybe it was just as well Hood did not know what was going on. He would find out soon enough. And besides, he was too exhausted to think. Hood was not just sleepy, but sapped of energy, of imagination. It had been a long and difficult 9 months since an electromagnetic pulse explosion had all but destroyed the National Crisis Management Center. Hood and his staff had not only been working around the clock to repair the facility and protect national interests, they had been looking for ways to streamline and economize, to reinvent Op Center in the wake of severe budget cuts. Hood also had a personal mission. He needed to find a way to fall in love with his job again. Op Center was not just a place, but the beating heart of American crisis management. Hood had been present for its birth, when the mission was uncorrupted and clear, and opportunity was boundless. He was also there for death and loss in Korea, Russia, Spain. It was odd. Triumphs, of which there were many, were short-lived. That was what professionals were supposed to achieve. Failures, of which there were fewer, hit harder. These included the deaths in the disbanded military unit Stryker and the assassination of political liaison Martha McCall. It also included the painful budget-induced firing of Hood's number two man, General Mike Rogers, over a half year before. Hood had done the best he could. He knew that. He had a shattered marriage to prove it. What he felt was that this place had somehow let him down, like a child you love and raise, and who falls short of what you expected or wanted or did not know you needed. Rogers had seen the exhaustion coming better than Hood had, the work it would take to resuscitate Op Center. The effort required to inspire the people doing two or three jobs instead of one, learning new equipment, being unable to turn to associates who were no longer there. But then Mike Rogers had been in bloody battlefield combat. He understood sudden, often debilitating loss. Hood had only been in politics, the kind of combat where injuries could be repaired or ignored. Op Center's intelligence chief, Bob Herbert, had a different way of seeing things. Herbert fired from the lip, which was hot-wired to the seat of his pants. Early in the rebuilding process, Herbert put Hood's life and labors in sharp perspective, as only the candid, politically insensitive Mississippian could.
"You know what a bombshell can do," Herbert reminded him. "With just a look, she can both fog your brain, clear your eyes, show you reality, and inspire a new one. But a bomb, Paul? That's pure destruction. It will break your spirit and body and will resonate through your soul. You'll hear the explosion and feel the shockwave every day for the rest of your life."
Like Rogers, Herbert knew what an explosion could do. The former CIA field operative had lost his wife and the use of his legs in the Beirut embassy blast of 1983. But Herbert was right about the damage the bombshell could cause as well, and there was a reason he made the comparison. Several years before, Hood happened to meet his former fiancée, Nancy Jo Bosworth, in Germany. The great love of his life had turned Hood's head, literally, and when he looked back at his life, it was no longer comfortable or satisfying. It took a trauma, a United Nations hostage-taking involving his daughter Harley, and a few more years for his marriage to Sharon to end. Bitter though it was, at least there was time to adjust, to make the inevitable crash landing as gentle as possible. The impact of the electromagnetic pulse explosion was much different. It took everything from Op Center in a flash. And the explosion didn't just necessitate the long and difficult rebuilding of Op Center. The power of the electromagnetic disturbance showed Hood and his colleagues how vulnerable modern technology was to a lone gunman with the proper tools. They realized how important it was to get all of American security resources up to speed to protect the nation. That weakness made the rebuilding process seem even slower. Now Op Center's reconstruction was done, and however tired Hood felt, the real work was just beginning. Though he was eager to undertake it, he was also struggling to motivate himself for what was coming next, the Monday morning senior staff meeting. There was a curious and surprising conflict taking place in Hood's head. The NCMC had done some significant work over the years, but that was in reaction to events, not prevention. Running Op Center was like bailing a rowboat. Success still left them deep in cold water, with the sea pouring in. Hood was unreasonably angry at Op Center for that. Nothing like this had happened when he was mayor of Los Angeles. He got frustrated, yes, with the city bureaucracy, but never enraged. But then his staff in City Hall were mostly career politicians, more dedicated to their own advancement and power than to their responsibilities. The people of Op Center were different. They had to be. They were ready to die for their work. It was as if their dedication, their sacrifice, had given this place a soul, a target for his frustration. Op Center was not supposed to get sick. The NCMC had been designed to be a constant in a world of changing dynamics and new challenges, with experts in every field and the technology to support their activities. Hood's people were devoted, and they were the best, but they required a support structure. They rallied after the explosion, but they were not able to do their jobs effectively for over half a year. Not that Hood had discussed this with them. It was all rah-rah as technical genius Matt Stoll supervised the electronic recovery and upgrades. There were heavy doses of can-do as they borrowed intel and data from other agencies so they could watch national and international hotspots. But through it all, Hood was crying inside. Staff psychologist Liz Gordon probably would have told Hood that he was having a serious bout of transference, laying what he felt about his failed marriage onto Op Center. Sharon Hood had let him down too in his mind.
She had failed to support his dedication to his career, his responsibility to the staff and the nation. Maybe it was true that Hood was shifting his feelings from one situation to the other. It did not change the fact that Op Center had taken on water, and the man in charge was angry and disappointed. To make matters worse, the bailing pail was smaller now. Fewer hands, less money. All Hood had wanted to do this morning was get the place on its feet and running. Instead, he finished his coffee, told his assistant Bugs Benet where he was going, and headed toward the elevator. Op Center was housed in a two-story building at Andrews Air Force Base. The two floors of upstairs offices were for non-classified operations, such as finance, human resources, and monitoring the mainstream news services for possible hot buttons. The basement was where the tactical decisions and intelligence crunching of Op Center took place. This executive level was accessible by a single elevator that was guarded on top 24/7. Hood acknowledged the guard with a nod and stepped into the parking lot. It was a glorious spring morning. He hoped the day stayed warm and welcoming. In Washington, the weather had a way of changing unexpectedly. Alexandria, Virginia, Monday, 8:11 a.m. Morgan Carey always regarded her career as a classic good news, bad news situation. 1 year before, at the age of 53, Carey was the first woman to earn the rank of three-star general in the United States military. It was a low-key promotion. The Army wished to promote a woman without calling attention to it. As her husband, Georgetown University Hospital neurosurgeon Dr. T.H. Albert Carey, put it, they wanted to break the glass ceiling without the sound of shattering glass. That was all right with the woman. Since she was a kid playing war games with her four older brothers, she wanted to be the officer she had become. At the same time, the career intelligence officer was passed over to head the National Security Agency in the new president's administration. Carey had spent most of her career in Army General Staff, familiarly G2, the last 5 years as its head. Her office was concerned with all aspects of intelligence gathering, counterintelligence, and security operations. On paper, she was more qualified than the man who got the job to oversee the organization that coordinates and executes the activities that protect American information systems and sources and generates foreign intel. But General Ted Dreiser was Air Force, and the new Vice President, Bruce Perry, was former Air Force. End of story. Or so General Carey had thought. At 8 p.m. the night before, the woman had received a call in her home in Alexandria, Virginia. She was being summoned to the White House for a short meeting with the President, the Vice President, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Raleigh Carew. All she was told was that the President had a question for her. Carey's driver took her to the West Wing, where she met with the three men for a total of 10 minutes. There was, as promised, just one question. The President gave her until this morning to answer it. As requested, the General had responded to the President in writing by 7 a.m. The letter was faxed to the White House and to the Pentagon. President Devenport had the answer he wanted, and General Carey had a little more history in her dossier. At 7:15, Carey received a call from the Vice President's Chief of Staff. A civilian driver would be coming to get her at 7:45. He would be carrying instructions in a sealed envelope. She would have 2 days to get her footing before meeting again with the President. It was all very quick and definitely very gratifying. And through it all, as ever, her husband of 38 years held her sure and steady as he held a scalpel. A nondescript navy blue sedan pulled into the driveway at exactly 7:45. The tall, lean neurosurgeon had delayed going to the hospital to hug his wife before she left. The woman, 5'7" and jogging slender, pressed her head to his chest. He put a big hand around her short-cropped white hair, gave his general a parting kiss on the forehead, and wished her well. She grabbed her leather briefcase and stepped into the bright morning. The driver was standing beside the car and opened the door. General Carey slid into the unfamiliar car. "There's a folder on the seat for you," the driver said. The general picked it up. She tore the red paper seal with an index finger. Inside were sealed manila envelopes. Each contained a concise dossier on the personnel of her new command. She flipped through them, looking for familiar names. As expected, there were only two, Bob Herbert and Stephen Veens. She knew Bob and his late wife Yvonne from the Middle East and Veens from his years with the National Reconnaissance Office. Both were solid professionals, though she had heard that Herbert was more of a loose cannon than ever. No matter. President Debenport wanted her to reconfigure Op Center, to run a tighter command. Either Herbert would fall in, or he would be replaced. Carrie started scanning the files to familiarize herself with the personnel she would be meeting today. Former political liaison, now Deputy Director Ron Plummer. FBI liaison Daryl McCaskey. Director of Tech Operations Matt Stoll. Psychologist Liz Gordon. The evaluations written by Paul Hood and his former number two, Mike Rogers, suggested that they were all rather individualistic, what the Army called rogues. Hood seemed to like and encourage that. Rogers did not. Carrie sided with Rogers. It would be a challenge to bring them around, but that was what Carrie had been waiting for her entire career. She did not intend to blow it. Washington, D.C., Monday, 8:29 a.m. Hood was taken directly to the Oval Office, where Chief of Staff Lorraine Sanders was leaning over the desk, talking with the President. Debenport waved Hood in. The President rose and offered Hood his hand. Debenport was a slope-shouldered man of average build. He had thinning straw-colored hair and a quick smile. He looked like a country pastor. His centrist views and unflappable nature made him a dramatic contrast to his predecessor, who was tall and dynamic, and had come close to a psychological breakdown from which Op Center had rescued him. Hood and the NCMC had also been instrumental in helping Debenport get elected, fighting off a threat from corrupt third-party candidate Donald Orr. That battle had earned Op Center the deadly EMP attack.
"Sit," the President said, gesturing toward a red leather armchair.
Hood did so. The President waited until Sanders sat before he did. The President asked Hood about his children as a server poured coffee and uncovered a tray of pastries. Until the server was gone, they could not discuss national security matters. Hood told him that Harley and her younger brother Alexander were doing well.
"I can't believe it's been over 2 years since the United Nations siege," Sanders remarked.
She was a lean five-footer with an intense look.
"I was deputy director of the State Department's New York office at the time. We were working with the FBI to put a SWAT scuba team into the East River when you and General Rogers ended the siege."
"Mike was really the one who ended it," Hood said. "I was just trying to get my daughter out."
Hood's voice choked as he spoke. He and Rogers had been through a lot. He owed the general a lot. The men had not spoken for 6 months, ever since the general had become the head of the military-industrial firm Unexus, an international cooperative formed by Australian, British, Russian, and American interests. The server left, and the door was shut. The President took a sip of tea and leaned forward.
"Paul, I asked you here because I need a favor. I need you to take on a project for me."
"Mr. President, do you need Paul Hood or Op Center?" Hood asked.
"I need you, Paul," Debenport replied. "I would like you to become special envoy to the President. The position entails international intelligence troubleshooting, unaffiliated with any group, but with access to the resources of all of them. Your office would be down the hall from this one, and you would report directly to me through Ms. Sanders, not through the Executive Secretary."
Hood thought the last 6 months had been a lot to process. This was complete information overload.
"Mr. President, I'm flattered," was all Hood could think to say.
"Then you're on board?" the President pressed.
"I'd like to think a bit, sir. This would be a big change."
"I need someone now, Paul. Someone I can rely on. I want it to be you."
"What about Op Center, sir?"
"No longer your concern," the President replied bluntly. "I have given the post to General Morgan Carey, formerly of G2. Her commission is effective immediately."
"You're saying, Mr. President, that either I accept reassignment or I'm fired," Hood said.
"Not at all, Paul. You can resign effective as of 8:30 a.m. this morning. You can say it was always part of your plan to get Op Center on its feet and move on."
"Sir, are you saying you need me here or are you saying you need me out of Op Center?" Hood asked.
"Both. Paul, the military is not happy with some of the budget initiatives this administration is taking. I have to equal the ledger.
By giving them op center?
In a word, yes. You're not a neophyte, Paul. You know that this is how things work. As for the new position, that's my way of maintaining balance. I need someone who will continue to interact with Op Center on a personal level and who will form close relationships with personnel at other intelligence agencies here and abroad.
You are saying, sir, that you want a personal intelligence officer.
Cabinet level without the title, the president said. And don't look so glum, Paul. That's a promotion.
I understand, sir. How will General Carew take my being here? Carew was chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
He will like it about as much as General Rogers liked serving under a civilian,
the president replied.
But he will have to live with that. Your only contact with the general will be when you require information from the NSA. You will not be at their disposal.
I see. What about staff, sir?
We have budgeted two assistants, both of your choosing,
Lorraine Sanders replied.
This office will not be looking over your shoulder,
President Davenport assured him.
What do you say? I need my own intelligence resource, my own confidant. I need Paul Hood.
Damn him, Hood thought. Damn the president for making something expedient sound desirable. And damn him for leaving me unemployed if I decline the offer. Hood had alimony and child support. He would not let indignation over the process affect his responsibilities. I accept the post, Hood told him. Durban, South Africa, Monday, 3:10 p.m. The Gold Coast of Africa is no longer the Gold Coast of Africa. The honor of being one of the richest, most profitable, and fastest-growing regions on the continent has passed from Western Africa along the Gulf of Guinea to the eastern coast of South Africa, with the city of Durban as the anchor. Because of the subtropical climate, the area has always been a perfect environment for growing. Beginning in the early 1850s, significant sections of arable land were earmarked for sugarcane. The crop was easy to cultivate and export, much in demand, and produced significant profits. Over a century and a half later, sugar continues to play a prominent part in South Africa's agriculture, with Durban as the biggest sugar port in the world. Tourism has grown as well, with miles of beachfront having been developed into one of the most popular and celebrated vacation spots in the world. Ever since the late 19th century, workers from the rest of the continent and from as far as India have come to work in the fields. Investors from other nations have come as well, creating an international mix unparalleled in most of Africa. Sugar silos, stuffed with raw brown sugar, stand side by side in clusters across the landscape. The 50-meter-tall towers are constructed of aluminum and steel, with a ceramic veneer to help control the temperature. They are connected at the top by enclosed bridges, which allow workers to move from one to the other. The air smells sweet around the structures, like cotton candy. En masse, the power of these 25-ton mountains is immense. South Africans regard the towers as the sentries of prosperity. They ensure economic security for this area, its investors, and its workers. The largest of the sugarcane repositories are located along the Maiden Wharf. The workers here, mostly from Kenya and Nigeria, see that the raw sugar stems move from truck to processing plant, to silo to freighter in a timely and efficient manner. 22-year-old native of Durban, Mashoud Azwi, directed trucks to the elevators that carried the sugar to the tops of the silos. There were few deliveries at this hour. Most were made in the morning, before the heat and dampness could affect the unsiloed sugar. Azwi was beginning to think about going to the tavern with his buddies when a dump truck arrived. It did not have the familiar logo of one of the firms that usually transported sugar to the silos. There was a loosely fitted tarpaulin stretched across the top of the truck to keep the sun off the cane. Azwi was standing on the ramp that circled three quarters of Concrete Bay 3. It was located beside the centermost of the six silos in this section. As the truck backed in, Azwi held up his hand so the driver could see. He was not supposed to allow anything to be offloaded without first checking the bill of lading. The young man jogged over to the driver, put a hand on the side view mirror, and dipped his head into the open window.
"May I see your documents?" he said.
The driver, a young man who looked Madagascan, turned to another man who was sitting in the passenger seat. The second man handed the driver a clipboard. He gave it to Azwi.
"Thank you,"
Azwi said as he looked at the document. He frowned deeply as he flipped through sheet after sheet. They were pages torn from the South African edition of Time magazine.
"What is this?"
Azwi demanded as he looked back into the cab of the truck. The young Durban did not have time to react before a silenced Beretta that had been concealed beneath the clipboard put a raw red hole in his forehead. He gasped softly as he dropped to the ground between the front wheel of the truck and the side of the bay. The man in the driver's seat jumped out and hurried to the back of the truck. The passenger also got out. He went to the elevator control box and pressed the blue button that opened the elevator door. The driver reached under the flap and removed a cooler. He popped the lid. The plastic container was packed with C4. He pulled a detonator from his jacket pocket, set it for 4 minutes, and jabbed it into one of the explosive bricks. Then he took the open cooler and put it on the elevator as it rose from the floor. He and the other man quickly removed 4 other coolers from the back and opened them. They contained a half dozen bricks of C4 each. He set the timers to blow 5 seconds after the initial blast. When the explosives had been offloaded, the elevator was sent back into the silo. It would travel under the ramp, then up an external chute, before being dumped into the top of the silo. The two men hurried back to the truck. They had watched the silos for several days from a motorboat. The entire process would take 3 minutes. That would give them enough time to get away. 100 seconds after the truck drove from the bay, the men were outside the chain-link fence that surrounded the silos. Moments after that, the C4 exploded. The blast blew out the top of the silo as if it were a party favor. Steel and ceramic tile were flung outward, along with huge pieces of fused sugar. The jagged sheets caught the late afternoon sunlight and flung it in all directions. The explosion sent the other coolers tumbling along the covered bridges on either side. They detonated as they reached the other silos, blasting out the sides and driving chunks of debris into the silos that were facing them along the northern side. Multiple booms echoed through the harbor. They were joined by sharp cracks as massive pieces of shrapnel ripped into the second row of towers, ripping off the tops and sending them into the water as powdery rain. Cracks appeared in the sides of all 6 silos, some hairline, some like vast geological fissures. The 3 most heavily damaged silos on the south surrendered first, dumping sugar and pieces of themselves onto the ground and against the adjoining structures. The impact caused the smaller fractures in the northern towers to expand, bringing them down within seconds. In less than a minute, the familiar Maiden Wharf landmarks were 6 distinct mounds of rubble beneath a cloud of smoke that smelled like roasting marshmallows. Washington, D.C., Monday, 9:11 a.m. Nothing ticked off a career intelligence officer more than not having intelligence. And right now, OpCenter's intelligence director was extremely ticked off. 48-year-old Bob Herbert sat quietly behind his desk, in his new state-of-the-art wheelchair. He appeared to be a man very much in control, but Herbert's emotions were bubbling. He had come to work a half hour before, after spending a long night overseeing the software setup of OpCenter's lean but crackerjack intelligence division. He had arrived expecting to experience an exciting startup with his colleagues, the culmination of 6 months of team effort. Instead, Herbert found something much different. A few minutes after Herbert had passed the upstairs guard, who logged him as present, information that went to the computers of all the division directors, Bugs Benet called to inform him that there was someone in Paul Hood's office, a 3-star general, a woman. She obviously had the creds to get downstairs. She had an ID card that gave her access to Hood's office when she swiped it through the lock, and she told Benet to call a meeting of the senior staff for 10 a.m. in the tank, the conference room at OpCenter. Then she shut the office door.
"That was the last I saw or heard of her," Bugs told Herbert. "I'm calling you first."
Herbert asked to be put through to the general. The woman took the call. She introduced herself as General Morgan Carey, the new director of OpCenter, and said she would brief Herbert and his colleagues at the staff meeting. When Herbert asked what that meant for Paul Hood, she told him she did not have that information and would see him in 45 minutes, and hung up. Washington, D.C., Monday, 10:40 a.m. The tank, got its name from the protection it afforded all electronic activity that was conducted within its walls. The room was completely surrounded by a barrier of electromagnetic waves that generated static to anyone trying to listen in with bugs or external dishes. It was the only section of OpCenter that had survived the EMP blast, and it served as the field headquarters for its reconstruction. General Carey arrived precisely on time and nodded once at the guarded faces of the five men and one other woman sitting around the oblong table. She recognized the key tactical department heads from their photographs. Technical Director Matt Stoll was to her left, OpCenter Attorney Lowell Coffey III was beside him, and FBI Liaison Daryl McCaskey was next to him. Bob Herbert sat at the foot of the table, with Deputy Director Ron Plummer to his left, and Liz Gordon beside him. Carey did not sit. She put her hands together in the small of her back and looked out at the room. "I am General Morgan Carey," she said to the group. "At the request of the President, I assumed the directorship of OpCenter commencing at 8:30 this morning. Unfortunately, I have no information regarding the disposition of former Director Hood. Perhaps one of you has spoken with him?" Most eyes looked down. A few heads shook slowly. "I will be pleased to share whatever information I am provided about Mr. Hood," Carey said.
"We had our differences, General, but he is our friend," Bob Herbert said.
Carey looked at him. "I am happy to hear that, Mr. Herbert. It gives me something to shoot for."
"That isn't why I mentioned it," Herbert replied. "This team has never relied on information that was provided to us. We dig it up. I want to make sure we know what happened to Paul, why and how."
"Or else?" General Carey asked. There seemed to be a threat in Herbert's tone.
"Think of it as the intelligence equivalent of leaving one of your troops behind in battle," Herbert told her. "Leave unanswered questions lying around and you will have a command, but you won't have trust or respect."
"That would be my problem," she replied sharply. "Your responsibility will be to do your job, not mine."
"My job description includes advising the director," Herbert said unfazed. "I believe I have just done that, General Carey."
Carey unfolded her hands and leaned on the table. "Do you have any other advice for me, Mr. Herbert?" she asked.
"None at present, General."
"Good, then I have some for you. There is a line between advice and criticism, and you just crossed it. Sometimes it's a word or a phrase, sometimes it's a tone. But cross it again in my presence, Mr. Herbert, and I will be able to tell this team exactly what happened to the former intelligence director of OpCenter." The general took a moment to study their reactions. She felt like the new Medusa. They were six faces cut in stone. Even Herbert. "I will be meeting with you all individually as time and responsibilities permit, starting with Bob." She looked at him. "Perhaps we can scroll things back and start fresh." Herbert's cheek twitched, and he dipped his forehead quickly. She took that for a go. "In the meantime, I need your help," General Carey went on. She opened her folder and looked at a printout. "There was an alert on my computer from Hot Button Operations upstairs. They looked into a pair of explosions that occurred this morning. One in Charleston, South Carolina at 5 a.m., and the other in Durban, South Africa at around 5 p.m. local time. The hobos suggest the attacks may have something in common. According to the Charleston Police Department, the ship that was blown up in their harbor was carrying illegal Chinese workers. The attack overseas 3 hours later destroyed sugarcane silos owned by a Chinese firm. The hobos suggest the second explosion was too swift to be retaliation, but both may be first shots in a broad war of some kind." She looked across the table. "Suggestions?"
"Many wealthy Chinese invest overseas because constraints on ownership of businesses and property are much less restrictive than in the PRC, Plummer said. "Illegal Chinese workers get smuggled into countries for an average price of 200 grand each, Daryl McCaskey said. They stay indentured, working as prostitutes or cheap labor until that sum is repaid. Since half the money they earn is sent to relatives in China, they are effectively enslaved for life. The FBI has been playing catch-up with these undocumented Chinese workers for decades. The Bureau has actually been losing ground since resources have been shifted to Homeland Security and the tracking of illegals from Malaysia, the Philippines, and the Middle East."
"Maybe we need to change the way the search is carried out," the general said.
"What are your thoughts?" Herbert asked.
"Hobo says that Chinese Americans represent 4% of the national population," Carey said. Most of those people are concentrated in cities like New York, San Francisco, and Philadelphia. Those are not areas in which we want to see a potential conflict spread. I suggest we have a look to see if there's a war brewing. Who takes point on that?
That depends where we want to run the operations, Herbert said. Two of our stringers are familiar with Africa. One of our local people can shoot down to Charleston.
That's catch-up, she said. I want to get ahead of this. What kind of resources do we have in Beijing?
A few stringers, Herbert told her. Our contact with the Chinese has been in proxy settings.
Maybe it's time to change the dynamics, Carrie said. Bob, maybe you can canvass the team and your resources, and we can have our sit-down over lunch in my office. We can go through whatever thoughts you have then and pin down a course of action.
Herbert nodded, this time more affirmatively. The general closed the folder.
If there's nothing else, I want to assure you that we will never forget or slight the contributions of those who came before us. Paul Hood, Mike Rogers, and especially the men and women who gave more than just their time and industry. Martha McCall, Lieutenant Colonel Charlie Squires, and the heroes of Stryker.
Darryl McCaskey pounded the table lightly with the side of his left fist, a gesture of tribute echoed by everyone else in the room. And for a moment, the tank seemed almost like home to General Carey. Beijing, China. Monday, 10:46 p.m. The 20th century Chinese communist leader, Liu Shaoqi, once said that there could be no such thing as a perfect leader in China. The nation was too large, its population too diverse. Balding, stocky Prime Minister Lei Kuan Po was not sure he agreed that China was ungovernable. But it was true that leading this nation of provinces, with vastly different histories and needs, required an individual of uncommon wisdom and resourcefulness. Lei Kuan Po was contemplating the complexities of gestures and appearances as his state car pulled away from the government building in the Chaoyang district of Beijing. His own life was full of careful maneuvers. For example, the prime minister had two cars. One was a Chinese-made Lingyang, the Antelope, and the other a more comfortable Volkswagen Polo, manufactured at the German-run plant in Shanghai. He rode the Antelope in Beijing, the Polo in the less populated countryside. Always a balance for appearances, he thought. Please the nationalists while holding something out for potential foreign investors. Except for the driver, the prime minister was the only passenger in the chauffeur-driven car. Typically, an aide and a secretary rode home with the 66-year-old. But the prime minister felt like being alone tonight. He wanted to reflect on the disturbing events of the day. He looked out the window as the car drove past the lighted monuments and palaces surrounding Tiananmen Square. It was a hot and rainy night. The vehicle moved quickly toward Lei Kuan Po's nearby Beijing residence on the top floor of the exclusive Cheng Yuan Towers apartment complex. The prime minister had another official home, a weekend retreat in the Beijing suburbs at the foot of Shouan Mountain. During the week, the prime minister preferred to remain in the city. It enabled him to watch those who wanted his job or sought to remove him as a thoughtful mediating influence. The prime minister enjoyed the tranquility of the countryside, yet that scenic agrarian world was China's past. The future was in the increasingly cosmopolitan capital and cities like Shanghai, with their proliferation of students and businessmen, many of them from rich Taiwan, the supposed enemy. That was an act for an acrobat greater than any the Beijing Opera had yet produced. Solving the Taiwan question. Chinese businesses were growing enormously due to investments coming across the strait. The Chinese military was being held to the budgetary levels of previous years as the threat from both Taipei and Russia was diminished. That did not make high-ranking career officers happy. Fewer commands meant fewer promotions. It caused grumbling up and down the ranks. Lei Kuan Po was a conservative career politician. He was not the prime minister solely because of his experience in government. He was here because, unlike his colleagues, he had not made any serious missteps. His background was spotted and propped with careful alliances and cautious agendas. The prime minister did not have the unilateral authority to act in any situation. In addition to the president and vice president above him, there was a cabinet with very powerful and ambitious ministers and the National People's Congress with its proliferation of special interests, both local and personal. The current struggle between Cho Xin,
head of the secretive 8341 unit of the Central Security Regiment, and People's Liberation Army hero General Tom Lee was outside the Prime Minister's experience. According to reports Lei Kuan Po had received from the Ministry of State Security, the Guoanbu, the two rivals had begun a long simmering facedown today in two foreign ports. And that was just part of the problem. Tom Lee was one of those officers who was unhappy with the lack of growth in the military. He could be a formidable threat to the stability of the nation. The Prime Minister did not know how he wanted to pursue this conflict between proud, stubborn, influential members of the government. It was not a matter he wished to present to the President or Vice President. Disputes between officials, even those with international ramifications, were the responsibility of the Prime Minister. The senior members of the current government, this Prime Minister included, remembered the taste and feel of disorder prior to Mao Zedong and the Communists coming to power in 1949. They did not want to see it return, not as a result of student demonstrations in Tiananmen Square or from disagreements among powerful members of the government. The Prime Minister lit a cigarette and exhaled smoke through his nose. Somehow he would have to convince the warring forces that he was a dragon, that the only way to defeat him was to put their differences aside and join forces. Lei Kuan Po did not know how he was going to do that. All he knew was one thing, that it had to be done, and done quickly. Beijing, China, Monday, 11:18 p.m. Cho Shin, director of the ultra-secret 8341 unit of the Central Security Regiment, the CSR, sat in his fifth-floor office in the old Communist Party building. It was located in the shadow of the Forbidden City, site of the palaces of the deposed despots who had run China for centuries. The director had the heat turned on, not only to chase out the chill of the stormy night, but to generate white noise. It helped to befuddle any listening devices that might be present. The 71-year-old Cho was waiting for an intelligence update from an operative in Taipei. What they were planning was dangerous, but as the day had proved, so was inactivity. While he waited, Cho reviewed what he called his cobblestone data, intelligence that was pulled from the street. This collection was done by a combination of paid informants, operatives who habituated bars and restaurants, hotel lobbies, and train depots just watching and listening, and electronic eavesdropping. Vans from the CSR drove through the streets of Beijing, listening to cell phone conversations and intercepting the increasing number of wireless computer communiques. Although the CSR had sifters on the staff who went through the raw data, what ended up crossing his desk had still managed to double in the course of a year. During the late 1950s, when Cho was recruited for the organization, the primary task of the 8341 unit was to see to the personal security of Mao Zedong and other Communist Party leaders. But the elite division of the People's Liberation Army was more than a bodyguard unit. It also ran a nationwide intelligence network to uncover plots against the chairman or senior leadership. The 8341 unit was a key participant in the 1976 arrest of the Gang of Four, the group that attempted to seize power after the death of Mao. Today, the 8341 unit was responsible for uncovering plots against the regime. Their sphere of activity centered upon China and the breakaway republic. Since the Tiananmen Square uprising in 1989, few dissidents had undertaken public displays against the government. Private activity was still relatively abundant but unthreatening, limited to pockets of philosophers, failed entrepreneurs, foreign-born firebrands, and disenfranchised youths who wanted fashionable Western clothes. At present, none of them represented a serious threat against the government. The only potential source of danger was the PLA, where one reckless, ambitious man might control the loyalty of tens of thousands of troops. A man like General Tom. Unlike the Prime Minister, Cho had no patience or sympathy for those who would betray the nation or the philosophies set out by Chairman Mao. Lei Kuan Po was a mediator. He was a man committed to equilibrium, to compromise. Cho liked the Prime Minister and believed he was a patriot. But Lei wanted to rule a China that was unified at any cost, even if it was a heterogeneous one and not a communist one. Cho did not agree with him on this very significant point. The computer beeped. The short, bespectacled intelligence director looked at the monitor. The cursor prompted him to enter a password.
He typed in the Chinese characters for Eagle and Talon and waited for the file to download. It was a report from one of Cho's field agents in Taiwan. The CSR director had been expecting the information. General Tom Lee had gone into this day with a plan he had hoped would undermine the resolve of the man who was watching him closely. The general seemed to have thought that violence and the threat of personal exposure would turn the eyes of Cho Shin elsewhere. Tom was not just wrong, he was decisively wrong, as he would discover in less than an hour. Taipei, Taiwan. Monday, 11:49 p.m. Lo Tech had a wonderful life. Part of that was due to the freedom he enjoyed, and part of it was the respect he had. Part of it was also due to the quaint simplicity of his world. Born Wei Ling Wang, Lo Tech was a name given to him by his associates because he refused to use any sophisticated electronic communications devices. He believed in being surreptitious, and one could not work in the darkness with all the electronic lights of the modern age. Most days and nights, the 32-year-old spent on his 94-foot ketch with its artful crew of three, sailing the waters of the Yellow Sea and the East China Sea. For the most part, his navigation was done the old-fashioned way, by wind and by starlight. Though he used a computer and DVD player for onboard entertainment, communication was conducted entirely with point-to-point radios. Lo Tech rarely left the sea. That was where he found refugees. Men, women, and youngsters, attempting to go from wherever they were to anywhere else. Mostly they were trying to get out of Indonesia or the PRC, and trying to get to Taiwan, Hong Kong, or Japan. More than half of the nearly 15,000 who set out each year perished on the water due to overloaded or inadequate boats, inclement weather, insufficient supplies, or pirates who robbed them of their few possessions, assaulted, then killed the women, and sank the boats. Of the 7,000 or so souls who managed to survive on the seas, 4,000 were turned away by coastal patrols, arrested, or sold by corrupt police to slavers who worked the docks. Typically, those were young women. Occasionally, they were young boys. Invariably, they were never seen again. Less than 1,000 individuals managed to make it ashore. Of those, fewer than 200 managed to find employment. The rest became thieves, prisoners, or corpses. Lo Tech had a very special business. His agents ran shipping services that helped refugees achieve their goals. The boats brought the cargo to Lo Tech, who brought the finest of the women on board and sold them to high-priced brothels in Taiwan, Thailand, Japan, and Hong Kong. In exchange for their silence, Lo Tech made sure the rest of the passengers reached their destination. In return for giving his boat safe passage from Chinese ports, Lo Tech made sure his contact in the PLA was well paid. General Tom Lee had been a valuable asset for many years and a frequent guest on his ketch. The young man felt no guilt about what he did. Statistically, without him, most of these girls would be dead within days or weeks. Lo Tech never abused them himself and left the training to the professionals ashore. He felt that he was doing the young ladies a favor, placing them in situations where they would be warm, fed, and given regular medical care. They would even earn money to send to their families, which was the reason most of them had left their homes. When Lo Tech came ashore, he liked to visit the clubs with whom he did business. They always treated him like nobility, excellent food and drink, and a reunion with one or more of his women. The top of the World Club at the new Bar Crown Tower was actually a legitimate nightclub with dinner, entertainers, and dancing. Only select guests knew to ask for special treatment. There were elegantly appointed rooms on the floor below for men with the time and money for what the club called exceptional treatment. After 2 weeks at sea, Lo Tech was in the mood for very exceptional treatment. During that time, the Chinese native had gathered a total of 30 women for clients along the Pacific Rim. Lo Tech arrived at the tower, was announced by the street-level doorman, and was greeted with an embrace from the manager when he reached the 40th floor.
"You should have called ahead," the manager said. "Give me a half hour and I will have things arranged for you."
"Thank you," Lo Tech replied. The men walked arm in arm as they went down a circular staircase into the main nightclub area. It was dark in the club, with a semicircular bar in the center and high tables scattered throughout. There was a raised dance floor behind the bar. The windows were floor to ceiling and covered 160 degrees of the circular room. They offered a commanding view of the city and the hazy lights of the harbor. Because it was still early, the club was relatively empty. A disc jockey was playing Asian pop standards from a booth overlooking the floor. There were two couples on the dance floor, three men and a woman in a group at the bar, and two young men bent over tall beers at one of the booths in the back of the room away from the window.
"What would you like to eat and drink?" the manager asked.
"I would like orange juice, freshly squeezed, no ice," Low-Tech replied.
"I'll get it at once," the manager said as he showed him to a booth in the corner near the window.
Low-Tech slid into the deep leather cushion. A stunning young waitress in a short black skirt brought him water, macadamia nuts, and a brilliant smile. The manager brought Low-Tech his drink, then left a check on the rest of your order, as he put it with a wicked wink. Low-Tech took an appreciative sip of the juice as he looked out at the club. He watched as the two men at the booth tossed several bills on the table and left. Neither of them carried a briefcase or backpack, which seemed unusual. He noticed, too, that both beer bottles had napkins around them. They were wrapped entirely around the glass, as though both men did not want to leave fingerprints. Low-Tech wondered if that meant anything, or if his naturally suspicious nature was getting the best of him. That was the last thought the slave trader had before his eardrums exploded, followed by the rest of the room. A bomb had been left in a briefcase under the table and was triggered remotely. It consisted of six sticks of TNT bound with electrical tape and capped with a detonator. The sticks were packed in a bed of sugar from Durban. The explosion fused the sugar into tiny shards, blowing them around the room like fireflies. The force of the blast did not just pulverize objects and people, it knocked them about like a Force 5 hurricane. Blood and alcohol were dashed against the walls, first by the TNT, and moments after that by the exploding CO2 canisters behind the bar. There were a few screams from below as the dance floor of the nightclub was shoved down into the exclusive rooms on the 39th floor. Moments later, there were cries from the streets as the big picture windows flew outward. Particles of glass rained down thickly like hail, clattering off rooftops, cars, and the street. People who were caught in the lethal rain were knocked to the pavement, some writhing with minor wounds, and others utterly still, impaled by the larger pieces of debris. Washington, D.C., Monday, 1:01 p.m. After Paul Hood was shown to his office, a young female intern came in and cheerfully showed him how to work his computer and telephone and gave him a swipe card for the men's room. After the young woman left, Hood sat alone with the door shut. Chief of Staff Sanders said she would come by at 3. She wanted to review her thoughts with Hood on how the new office might work. She assured him, however, that the decision would be his, and he would have full autonomy on the final setup. "As long as you agree," Hood thought. Otherwise, the new special envoy would be removed, and someone else would get the job. That was how things worked in the nation's capital. Hood felt alone. He was at the seat of power, yet he felt strangely powerless. It would be odd not to receive hourly intelligence reports from the research rooms upstairs. It was frustrating not to have anyone of a Bob Herbert or Daryl McCaskey caliber to consult. "That is not entirely true," he reminded himself. Hood owed Bob Herbert a phone call. He reached for the phone.
"Paul, what the hell is going on?" Herbert asked.
"More changes," Hood replied. "I'm the new special envoy to the president."
"Special envoy to where?"
"Everywhere. I am still an international crisis manager."
"Did you know that this was coming? Any of it, including the changing of the guard over here?"
"No," Hood said.
"Neither did I, and we're intelligence professionals."
"How is everyone taking the change?" Hood asked.
"I don't know," Herbert admitted. "Numb, I guess. We had a staff meeting this morning and everyone was pretty quiet, but I really haven't talked to anyone. I've been looking into this situation we have."
"Can you talk about it?" Hood asked. He wanted to put on his professional hat as soon as possible.
"Sure," Herbert replied. "Someone out there is capping Chinese interests abroad. There have been 3 incidents in one day.
General Carey wanted to know if they are connected or if we need to be concerned about that.
Do you?
It's too early to say. Charleston police report finding the remains of Chinese stowaways in the harbor. An hour ago, there was an explosion at a nightclub in Taipei. Special guests received special treatment there.
From mainland Chinese girls, Hood said.
You see where this is going, Herbert replied. We do not believe that someone is attacking men and women who leave China. We suspect the target is the enabler, whoever is helping them to get out and making money from their sale in Taipei or the United States. Darryl just got off the horn with a friend in the Taipei Municipal Police Department. They were at the site within minutes. They found a badly wounded fellow who has since been identified as Wei Ling Wong, a suspected slaver. He died on the way to the hospital, but they found his boat in the harbor.
Did they get any phone records, computers?
Nada. The guy never used any of those. He had a nickname, Low Tech. All his deals were conducted in person or arranged via ship-to-ship or ship-to-shore communications.
Do you think Wei Ling was the target?
No, Herbert said. It would have been just as easy to take out his catch. He was probably just a bystander who happened to deserve what he got.
So the business was the target?
Yes, but Ron and General Carey both think there might be a proxy war being fought here. I'm inclined to agree.
Those words were not a slap. They were worse. Hearing Herbert mention Ron Plummer and General Carey in the same sentence was like hearing his former wife talk about her new boyfriend. It reminded Hood painfully that forces beyond his control had wrested him from people and events that had defined his life. It was an effort to speak, let alone to speak unemotionally.
Why do you think that? Hood asked flatly.
The PRC has an enormously high rate of illegal immigration. In terms of sheer numbers, it's higher than that of any other nation. Those refugees were the people Wong reportedly hunted. He would not have been able to pluck people from offshore vessels without the tacit approval of the People's Liberation Navy. Wong had to be paying people off.
Do you have any idea who?
Not yet, Herbert said. But we may have a backdoor to that information. The attacks in Charleston and Taipei bookended the bombing of sugar silos in South Africa. According to public records in Durban, one of the investors in that refinery is the Tonkin Investment Corporation, a group of Vietnamese shipping entrepreneurs who have close ties with members of the Chinese government. Specifically, they handle official government investments managed by Cho Shin, who is the vice chairman of the Chinese Communist Party's United Front Relief Fund. The Chi-Com UFRF manages funds for the survivors of soldiers who died in the struggle to put the communists into power and keep them there. Cho is a hardliner, an acolyte of Mao who also happens to be the director of the 8341 unit of the Central Security Regiment.
I've heard of them, Hood said. They're extremely low profile.
Very. Their job is to spy on political and philosophical enemies of Chi-Com at home and abroad. Cho has deep files on students, radicals, black marketeers, and plutocrats. He also has the resources to attack the trade in illegal emigres.
For what reason? Hood asked.
Defense? Spite? The profits could be used to finance rival factions in Beijing, or maybe he has a grudge against some minister or general. What's interesting is the timing of the events. The first two, the blasts in Charleston and Durban, happened relatively close together.
You mean someone might have had the silo scenario primed in the event of an attack on the emigres?
Right. But the blast in Taipei came significantly later. Possibly a response to the bombing in Durban.
That isn't a proxy war, Hood said. It's gods hurling thunderbolts at one another.
Not giving a damn about collateral damage, I know, Herbert said. In any case, Maria has Interpol connections who deal regularly with the National Security Bureau in Taipei. They got people inside Beijing. We're trying to find out who is on the top of Cho's hit list, someone who might have the resources to have the counterstrike in Durban ready and waiting.
Maria was the Spanish-born wife of OpCenter's FBI liaison, Daryl McCaskey. She had retired from Interpol to come to the United States with her new husband. She had not settled comfortably into domesticity and was retained by OpCenter to interface with the Global Police Agency and its affiliates.
So, who are we rooting for? Hood asked. The slaver capitalist or the repressive spy who's watching out for war widows?
It was a rhetorical question, and Herbert took it as such.
Sad thing is, people end up suffering either way, the intelligence chief remarked. I hope there's something you can do to minimize that. Are there any resources you can bring to bear? Herbert asked. I'll find out. Great. There's an incoming call I better take.
Sure, Hood told him. I'll get back to you.
Thanks.
Hey, Paul, have you heard from Mike lately?
I haven't spoken to him since he left Op Center. Why?
Because that's who's calling me, Herbert replied.
Hello, Mike Rogers, Herbert declared as he took the call. How are things deep in the heart of your Nexus?
The company's doing well, and so am I, Rogers replied.
Is there something quick and dirty I can help you with, or can I give you a shout in about an hour?
Both, Rogers said. What are you hearing about China?
Why do you ask?
We've got a very important project about to launch with Beijing, Rogers told him. I was wondering if the explosion in Taipei is an isolated event.
Do you have any reason to think it wasn't? Herbert asked.
There was a brief silence. Herbert smiled. Rogers knew the drill. Herbert's first obligation was to Op Center. Their job was to put puzzles together, not provide the pieces for others. Not even for an old friend, a trusted friend.
All right, I'll go first, Rogers said. Unexus has designed a Chinese telecommunications satellite that is going to be launched on Thursday. The Prime Minister has asked the head of Xichang Space Center to provide him with an overview of security operations. Director Lung says that has never happened before.
Is this the first job you've done with them?
Yes, but that does not seem to be what is driving the Prime Minister's caution, Rogers told him.
Will the telecommunications satellite be used for civilian purposes only?
We don't know.
Plausible deniability, Herbert replied.
Rogers ignored the remark.
The Prime Minister has asked that the security information be sent by courier directly to him. Ordinarily, these matters are reviewed by the Guoanbu.
The Ministry of State Security, Herbert said.
Bypassing them in a review of this nature is very unusual. Director Lung was also instructed to make sure that one of the guests be accompanied by a Xichang official at all times.
What guest? Herbert asked.
General Tom Lee of the PLA,
Rogers told him.
Is the army involved with the launch?
Only as observers. We hope to be doing more business with them in the future, though I'm not at liberty to say more than that.
Is there any reason at all to think that this General Tom Lee is a threat?
That's why I'm calling. The Prime Minister must think so.
When did the Prime Minister request the security plans? Herbert asked.
Saturday morning, Beijing time. Now tell me, is there anything you can add?
Is this for your ears only, or will it get back to the Prime Minister of the People's Republic of China?
Do you even have to ask, Bob?
Unfortunately, I do, Mike. You're a good friend. You're also a private citizen working with the government of a foreign power, possibly with the military of a foreign power. My boss would scowl at swapping spit with the enemy.
Tell Paul I am the same man I was.
Paul Hood is not my boss, Herbert said. Not anymore.
It took Rogers a moment to process the information.
What are you talking about? He asked.
I wish I knew, Herbert admitted. I came to work this morning and found out that Op Center had a new director effective immediately. General Morgan Carey, do you know her?
I know of her,
Rogers said.
From what I gathered, Paul was invited to work for the president in some new capacity.
Did Paul sound happy?
He sounded uncertain, dislocated.
That's as good as it's going to get for him,
Rogers said.
If you're not part of the inner circle to start, you aren't likely to get in. That's the same as a political execution.
This conversation was taking them down a rutted path Herbert did not want to travel.
We can talk about all this some other time, Herbert told Rogers. Meanwhile, here's what I can tell you about the Chinese. It isn't much, but I'm working on it.
Herbert filled Rogers in on what he knew about the three explosions.
Do you think those are all related?
Slave labor was involved in the harbor and brothel attacks. A spymaster, Cho Shin, apparently ran holdings in the sugar processing facility that was destroyed.
I've heard of Cho, Rogers said. He's a real hardliner.
That he is. Have you heard anything else about him?
His name showed up a lot in a white paper on the Tiananmen Square uprising. He was out there running plays for the police, pointing out individuals he wanted for interrogation. They call him the Eagle, because of the way he just looked down from a balcony and plucked people from the square.
I don't understand. Why would a diehard Red invest in capitalist enterprises?
The Annexus think tank was all over that question when we got involved with the Chinese,
Rogers told him.
What we view as naked capitalism, Beijing regards as a means of control. Think about it. How does a foreign country gain influence in the United States? Through real estate holdings, owning businesses, even laundering money through banks. They help to drive our economy. That helps elected officials stay elected. It gives you their very attentive ear. How does a foreign government make money for those often extravagant enterprises? They invest in something people will always need, like sugar or tobacco, diamonds or gold.
I guess that makes a kind of lopsided sense, Herbert admitted, as long as you don't become what you seek to destroy.
You know as well as I do that a lot of sleeper agents and fifth columnists are seduced by a better life and a big bankroll.
Okay, I understand why Cho might have invested in a sugar refinery. What I don't understand was whether this attack was against the silos, the investment, or Cho himself.
I have no idea. I just don't want to worry that our satellite is in jeopardy.
Do you expect China to be a big part of your business in the future?
We hope so, but that's not my biggest concern.
What is?
The satellite has an RTG,
Rogers told him. Herbert grunted. An RTG is a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, a lightweight, very compact system that provides energy through the natural radioactive decay of plutonium-238. Though the plutonium is encased in a lead ceramic alloy that would survive a crash or explosion, there was always the chance of an accident, one that could spread lethal radioactivity across a wide swath of the countryside.
So nuclear power is going to be part of what New Nexus offers in the future.
I can't really talk about that, Bob.
I understand. It's too bad you're not tighter with the Prime Minister. You could put the question to him.
Do you think Paul might want to take a swing at that?
Rogers asked.
The White House has ways of communicating with the Prime Minister that we don't.
Good point. Call him, Herbert suggested.
I will,
Rogers said. Beijing, China. Monday, 2:27 a.m. Prime Minister Lei Kuan Po went home to his wife Li Li and a late snack of tea and apricots. Throughout his adult life, Li Li had been his most valuable and trusted friend and advisor. They had been discussing the radical differences between Cho and Tam Li. Li Li believed her husband should work behind the scenes to undermine the men.
Remove their support structure and they will fall, she counseled. What you must do is relocate their aides, their allies, their confidants.
That was when Dai Ming Wang, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, called on the Prime Minister's cell phone. Dai Ming informed him about the explosion in Taipei. Lei was not happy to learn of the disaster, nor to hear of it from Dai Ming. The foreign minister wanted very much to become Prime Minister.
Three incidents in one day,
Dai Ming said in conclusion.
We need to contain this situation immediately.
His motives did not change the fact that the foreign minister was right, which is what made him a danger.
I will handle this, the prime minister said. What can I do to assist?
Dai Ming asked solicitously. Lei lit a cigarette, blew smoke, and thought for a moment.
I will call Cho and Tam Li and arrange a meeting, he said. I would like you to attend. Certainly. When would you like to meet?
I will let you know, Lei replied cautiously. He folded away the phone and looked across the table at his wife. He told her what had happened.
War between these two men will force others to take sides, he concluded. I need to do something about it. You are anxious. You should wait until morning before contacting them,
Li Li suggested.
I cannot afford to let the situation escalate. You are also tired, his wife insisted. Mao said that a dull-witted army cannot defeat the enemy. They are tired as well. I have to find out if either of these men were involved in the attack. Three nations suffered covert attacks today. As the Prime Minister of China, I have ways of passing information to those nations. Information such as the names of the people who organized the bombings. I need never soil my hands.
Arlington, Virginia. Monday, 2:44 p.m. Since his days as a military commander in Vietnam, Mike Rogers maintained that there were two phases to any operation. This belief was borne out during his tour of duty at Op Center, where the general was both deputy director under Paul Hood and commander of the elite rapid deployment military unit, Stryker. It was also proving to be true at UNexus. The first stage of a project was the booster phase. Whether it was a military incursion, a research program, or even a business deal, it always started with heavy lifting. Someone had to have and then sell an idea. Once it was successfully off the ground, it entered the pitch and yaw phase. That was a time of fine-tuning. The project had a life of its own. All the creator could do at that point was make sure it did not crash or self-destruct. The Chinese operation, as Rogers called it, was in the pitch and yaw stage. The scientists had specific requirements. The investors in Europe and the United States had needs, and now the Chinese had concerns. Some of them conflicted, such as the propulsion engineers needing access to the booster and the Chinese not wanting them entering the gantry area without Chinese scientists, who had their own ideas about how things should be done. Rogers wasn't sure how he felt about calling Paul Hood now. He had been allowed to resign from Op Center after it was downsized. Though the cutbacks were not Hood's fault, Rogers felt the director had not fought hard to keep him. He understood why. Paul Hood had the larger picture in mind, the continuation of Op Center in the wake of severe budget cuts. But understanding and forgiving were not the same. Now Paul Hood had been replaced. Maybe the White House position was better for Hood in some ways, but it was still a very sudden take-it-or-leave-it offer. Rogers did not need to gloat. However, he also did not want to be a friend to Hood. That was a status Hood had never earned. Rogers called the White House switchboard. They put him right through.
This is Paul Hood. Christ, Paul, didn't they even give you an assistant?
It took a moment for Hood to place the voice. Mike?
It is,
Rogers replied.
Bob told me where to find you.
Geez, I'm glad he did. How the hell are you?
I'm doing terrific,
Rogers assured him.
The change has been very good for me.
I can imagine, Hood said. How does it feel being in the private sector for the first time?
I'm happy, and my bank account is happy,
Rogers admitted.
Speaking of changes, what can you tell me about this new position of yours?
Not a hell of a lot yet. The position was described as an international intelligence troubleshooter unaffiliated with any group but with access to the resources of all of them.
What about political access through the president?
You mean working heads of state? Hood asked.
Exactly. In particular, I wonder if that includes getting the ear of the Chinese Prime Minister?
I don't know. Does it pertain to intelligence troubleshooting?
It does,
Rogers said.
Impacting the private or public sector?
Public there, private here.
Here meaning UNexus.
Right,
Rogers said.
Maybe you had better give this to me from the top, Hood suggested.
Rogers told him what had happened with Lei Kuan Po and the Xichang Space Center and the exclusion of the Guoan Bu from the equation. Hood seemed surprised to hear that.
What you really need to know is whether the Prime Minister has specific information or concerns that your satellite may be a target, Hood said.
Their satellite, our subcontract. It's 3 days until launch. I'm hoping the Prime Minister is just being cautious, but I would like to know.
What does Bob say about all this?
He's going to sniff around from downwind, but you know what our human resources are like.
Like most intelligence agencies, Op Center had cut back on expensive human intelligence and relied primarily on ELINT, electronic intelligence. That was fine, as long as adversaries used cell phones and emails, or spoke in public places where the agencies had VARDs, videographic or acoustic reconnaissance devices. If not,
the analog fish slipped through the digital net.
Lorraine Sanders will be here in a few minutes, Hood said. Let me talk to her about this, see what she thinks.
Rogers thanked him and hung up. Conflicted did not begin to describe how Rogers felt at the moment. When they were talking about Herbert and his limited human capabilities, Rogers had called them our resources. Even 6 months later, it was difficult not to think of them all as a team. Hood, Herbert, and Rogers had gone through a lot together, more than most men get to experience in a lifetime. The deaths of co-workers, family crises, fighting the clock to prevent civil wars and nuclear attacks. Perhaps they always would be a team, despite working from different places toward different ends. And perhaps what the sage once said of divorce was also true of Mike Rogers and Paul Hood. That going separate ways wasn't a sign two people didn't understand one another, but just the opposite. An indication that they had begun to. Washington, D.C., Monday, 3:18 p.m. Bob Herbert called General Carrie and brought her up to date on his conversation with Mike Rogers. Rogers had also spoken with Paul Hood and had phoned to tell Herbert about that. Hood was going to see what he could do about getting intel from the Chinese Prime Minister. Carrie thanked Herbert and hung up. 10 minutes later, Darryl McCaskey and Matt Stoll came by Carrie's office for a meeting. Matt was carrying a compact disc on his index finger.
We may have caught a break, McCaskey said. There was a man at the club who Interpol and the Taipei police were watching. He was a reputed slave trader known by the name Low Tech. He died in the blast. Agents were at the nightclub with acoustic devices, hoping he would say something that would give them a reason to arrest him. They were wearing wide wires, digital wide-frequency recorders that collect every sound in a room and send it to a central location where the extraneous noises are removed. The agents were killed in the blast, but everything they recorded was sent to a mobile unit not far from the club. Through my Interpol connections, we got a copy.
Stoll held up the CD on his finger.
The explosion destroyed everything within 100 yards of the epicenter, McCaskey went on. The bombers knew the blast radius, of course, and made sure they were beyond that when they activated the bomb. We got the guys talking on the stairwell, Madam General, Stoll said. They were breathing hard, moving real fast, and speaking Cantonese.
So they were probably from the mainland, the general remarked.
What did you get? Until the blast killed the wide wires, we managed to pick up their names, Stoll told the general. More important, we got remarkably clear voice prints.
Like fingerprints, voice prints were unique to every individual. Stoll placed the CD on the general's desk.
We passed those charts back to Interpol and the Taipei police, McCaskey said. They've mobilized all their ELINT units, including those of the military. They've sectored the city and are scanning every cell phone call being made.
So we have PRC bombers working in Taiwan, Carrie said. Hired hands?
We believe so. The working theory is that it's the Tang Wars redux, right down to fighting of brothels and the trafficking of slave girls, McCaskey said. Foot soldiers working for gang leaders. In this case, though, and it's the worst-case scenario, the leaders could be Beijing heavyweights. It'll be tough to get to them. We don't have a deep well of human personnel, and none over there. Are there resources you can call on?
There may be, she said. Let's wait and see what the CA patrol turns up over there.
CA was a chase and apprehend mission. In Carrie's experience, it was more often than not a full-fledged cat operation. Chase, apprehend, and terminate.
Most spies and enemy infiltrators did not like to be apprehended. Washington, D.C., Monday, 5 p.m. Lorraine Sanders came to Hood's office as scheduled. She gave him a CD containing intelligence matters that concerned the president. Hood promised to review them.
I would also like to talk to him about a matter involving the PRC, Hood told Sanders.
Talk to me, she said.
Prime Minister Lei Kuan Po has requested information about an upcoming satellite launch at the Xichang Space Center. The satellite was built by Unexus, the firm run by my former deputy Mike Rogers. He's concerned that there may be an attempt to sabotage the booster.
Unexus is a firm with a minor American component, isn't it?
I don't know the exact proportion.
Why should this administration be concerned about what is basically foreign-built hardware for a potentially hostile government?
The trajectory will carry the rocket over the Pacific, Hood said. If it blows up after launch,
Radiation from the plutonium power source is going to hit the atmosphere like Mardi Gras confetti. Some of that could come down in Hawaii or along the West Coast.
I see, Sanders said. And do you really think the Prime Minister will tell us what he knows?
The Chinese obviously have some kind of spitting contest going on. He may be ready for a hand.
Sanders nodded and looked at her watch. The President will be finishing his meeting with the Joint Chiefs in about 5 minutes. I'll pass this along.
Fine. But before you go, tell me why I had to stand here and justify my request, Hood said. It was my understanding that I'd like a minute with the President was all I needed to tell you.
She smiled. You think too much, she said. I'll let you know what the President says. The phone beeped as Sanders was leaving the office. The room was small enough so that Hood could grab the call and tap the door shut with his foot at the same time. He was aware of a sharpness in the little kick, a little stuff-it gesture to the retreating chief of staff.
Paul Hood, he said.
Paul, it's Bob. The Taiwanese screwed up.
How?
The bombers got away, Herbert said. The police tracked them via their cell phone to a hotel. They killed two cops and blew up the cell phone. We aren't going to be hearing from them again.
Aren't the police still looking?
No one saw them, Herbert said. No one who survived. And the descriptions from the hotel workers are not giving them enough to go on.
What are the implications? Hood asked, adding, I don't just mean for Mike's launch.
That's tough to say, Chief, Herbert said.
Was the use of the title a lapse or a sign of respect? Hood didn't know, but it was nice to hear.
It's not likely that these were the same people working in Charleston or Durban. They'd be two very tired men, and you don't want tired men handling explosives. If there's a network of bombers and they were already positioned only in soft targets, for whatever reason, I would say the rocket launch is safe. But these three blasts could be the warm-ups for one or more big attacks. Perhaps the Prime Minister has insight we lack. We need to find out.
I agree, Hood said.
Did you make progress on your end?
I'm about to, Hood replied. I'll call you when I get back from Olympus.
The new special envoy to the President hung up the phone and left his office. The Joint Chiefs were making their way down the corridor like a green glacier. They were talking quietly among themselves, ignoring the non-military staff that moved past them. At the end of the hallway, Hood entered the office of the President's Executive Secretary, Julie Kubert. She greeted him by name. The door to the Oval Office was open to her left. Devonport was on the phone.
I'd like to see the President, Hood said.
The white-haired woman looked at her computer.
How is tomorrow morning at 10:15?
Today, Hood said. Now would be good.
The President of Laos is waiting in the Red Room, Mr. Hood.
Miss Kubert, there's something going on that I must discuss with the President, and soon.
If it will shut you up, Paul, come in, Devonport said.
Thank you, Hood said to Kubert.
Then he turned and entered the Oval Office.
I'm sorry, Mr. President, but I need to speak with Prime Minister Lei Kuan Po.
The Chinese fence-sitter,
the President said.
Why?
He may be sitting on intel we need, Hood replied.
Lorraine Sanders rushed in. She obviously had been alerted by Ms. Kubert. The Chief of Staff said nothing as she took up a position beside the President's desk. Arms folded, she glared at Hood. Hood ignored her. He told the President what he had already explained to Sanders, adding the new information from Bob Herbert. He made the presentation as concise as possible. The President listened, then rose and walked from behind the desk.
Miss Sanders, have Ambassador Hazen look into a meeting, the President said. Paul, get yourself over to our embassy in Beijing.
Sir?
If there's infighting in Beijing, we need to know. It might help to have General Rogers with you. He can go to observe the launch, I presume.
I don't see why not.
As for Ops Center, I want you to talk to General Carey before you leave. The Joint Chiefs were just in here. They mentioned something in passing that obviously dovetails with this.
What's that, sir? Sanders asked. It was an obvious effort to become part of a project she had not felt was terribly important. Until right now.
General Carey has requested that a small group of Marines be seconded to Ops Center for a possible security mission in Beijing, the President told Hood. One that will be defined as information becomes available.
Did she say what kind of security mission it would be?
Hood asked.
The president said it would be defined later, Sanders said.
Hood ignored her.
What I mean, sir, would it be at the launch site, at the embassy, or a black ops action somewhere else?
The Joint Chiefs did not tell me, and I did not ask. There was no point. As I told you before, Paul, General Carey was pushed on me as the head of Ops Center. If the military is planning some kind of new and covert direction for Ops Center, I want to know what it is, not what they tell me it is.
Understood, Hood said.
It's good you have someone you trust on the inside,
the president told him.
Tell Herbert to keep one eye on the NCMC and one on his ass.
He winked as he headed toward the door. Hood looked over at Lorraine Sanders. Her arms were still crossed, and her expression was still sour.
I'll have the travel office arrange for a ticket to Beijing, she said to him.
Thanks. She walked toward the door, stopping beside Hood.
If you do that again, I'll feed you to General Carew. I swear it.
Are you working for him? Should the president be concerned?
No, she replied thickly. I just happen to know the general likes chewing up starchy little bureaucrats.
Beijing, China. Tuesday, 4:40 a.m. The prime minister arrived at his office shortly after 3 a.m. His visitors were already there. He had made them wait. Blinking hard to chase away the fog of exhaustion, Lei Kuan Po looked over data that had been sent from the Xichang Space Center, hand carried by his aide, and placed in a safe. Against opposition, Lei had supported international involvement with the project. It was not just a matter of having a sophisticated communication satellite at their disposal. It was a question of being able to deconstruct the technology, study it, and build the next generation of homegrown Chinese satellites. A number of old-school members of the government did not like the idea of commissioning work from other nations. Stealing blueprints and technology was acceptable, a legitimate function of the state. Paying for it was to admit a need, to show weakness. Men like Cho Xin were unyielding in matters like that. What Lei did not know was whether they were willing to promote internecine warfare. The security arrangements were no different than they were for other launches. Unless he could forge some kind of peace very soon, that would have to change. Cho and Tom Lee both had access to the old codes. They knew the standard distribution of manpower throughout the site and what areas engineers would be watching as the countdown progressed. They knew that this was the centerpiece of the National Day celebration honoring the founding of the People's Republic of China. Something would have to be done about this. Lei would try reasoning with the men, though that had never worked in the past. Perhaps now, with their feud becoming public, their attitude would be different. A news report from Taiwan had just arrived. It underscored the need for someone to take control of the situation. Lei read about the attempted arrest and escape of the two bombers at the top of the World Club. The bombers had been staying at a Taipei hotel that was a safe house for Chinese spies and had killed two police officers while making their getaway. There was no doubt in Lei's mind that the bombers were working for one of the men waiting to see him in the next room. To clear his mind, the Prime Minister also reviewed an updated guest list for the reception he would be hosting the following evening. A few ambassadors had been added, and several journalists had been removed. Leading academics in the sciences and arts would also be attending. Lei's daughter, Anita, was among them. The 40-year-old woman was a professor of literature and head of the doctoral arts program at Beijing University. Poised, articulate, and lovely, she was a favorite of the premier. The cocktail party was in honor of the 58th National Day. The reception was an opportunity for people to mingle and exchange ideas, at least on the surface. When he was ready, Lei Kuan Po went to the sitting room adjoining his office. The foreign minister was pacing. Cho Xin was sitting in a red leather armchair with his chin on his chest and his eyes shut, and General Tom Lee was tucked against one side of a white sofa. Only the foreign minister reacted to the prime minister's arrival.
Is everything all right?
Dai Ming asked solicitously.
We would not be here if it were, Lei said as he shut the office door.
He walked toward the men. Cho woke and sat up straight. Lei sat in a rocking chair. He told the three men about the escape of the bombers from the Taipei Hotel. The men seemed surprised by the news. For different reasons, the prime minister suspected.
Do the Taiwanese police know who the hotel guests were?
Cho asked.
Which information is the director of the Guoambu concerned about?
General Tom Lee asked.
The names of the men, or the fact that Taipei might have identified them?
Cho did not reply. The Prime Minister regarded the spy chief.
I would like to know the answer to that, Director Cho.
The 71-year-old hardliner snickered.
Is that why we were called from our beds? To be interrogated by an amateur?
The technique is not important. The information is, the Prime Minister replied.
It is no secret that the distinguished director of the Guoanbu and one of our most honored soldiers are not getting along. The foreign minister has kept me informed about attacks against Chinese interests abroad. These incidents do not seem to have been random. I hope both of you can tell me more about them.
My interest in Taipei is professional,
Cho replied. He regarded Tom Lee for the first time.
As for this honored soldier, the general and I have a very different vision of China and its place in the world. My views are in accord with the values and policies of the Zhuangguo Guangshangdong. His are not.
Cho was near reverent when he mentioned the Communist Party of China. The spymaster obviously did so to suggest that an attack on him was an attack against the nation itself. General? Lei asked.
I do not intend to sit here as my devotion to our nation and its party are questioned,
Tom Lee replied.
Director Cho has failed to answer the Prime Minister's question. I would like to know the answer as well. I would also like to know whether the resources of the Guoambu are being used in ways other than their regulations permit.
Is there evidence of this? The Prime Minister asked. He looked from the general to the spy chief. Neither man spoke. The Prime Minister had the authority to empanel a special Bureau of Investigation to examine these matters. But an SBI would not act quickly, and the Prime Minister needed immediate results, especially if the launch might be at risk. He also needed to keep the Foreign Minister from moving against him.
Does the Foreign Minister have any comments?
Lei asked.
Chinese citizens were killed in the United States and Taipei,
Dai Ming said.
I would suggest at the very least an oversight committee be formed to collect information from foreign sources.
To place blame or redirect it?
General Tom Lee asked. Lei regarded the officer.
I ask again, General. Do you have information you wish to share?
None,
Tom Lee told him.
Only an observation. Absent detente, this situation will escalate.
The Prime Minister did not bother to ask him how or when. No one seemed to want to say anything incriminating, something that might help an opponent.
What would it take to establish peace? Lei asked.
There can be no peace without a singular vision,
Cho said.
We have a system of beliefs in China, one established by great men, one put in place through the sacrifice of millions of lives. There can be no deviation from that.
Tom Lee lit a cigarette. His pale eyes were fixed on the glowing tip.
The number of smokers in China surpasses the population of the United States. Should all of us smoke the same brand? Should those who do not smoke be forced to do so? I am told by my physician that millions of souls have died for that right as well. Your comments are sickening,
Cho snapped.
They diminish the sacrifice others have made.
I had hoped to provide perspective,
Tom Lee replied quietly.
You failed, Cho said. Mr. Prime Minister, this meeting is pointless and I am tired. Is there anything else we need to discuss?
Not at the moment, thank you,
Lei replied. The spy chief had just given him what he needed. The head of the Guoanbu bowed slightly toward the foreign minister, then to the prime minister, then left.
Ideologues are easy to bait,
the general said.
Why did you want to?
Lei asked.
You do not advocate our political philosophy?
I support the land,
Tom Lee replied.
I support China, whatever form that takes. One day it is a dynasty, an empress. One day it is a party called communism. The next day, we are all looking the other way as Hong Kong and Taiwan force us to tolerate new ideas.
Not everyone tolerates them,
the Prime Minister pointed out.
No, Director Cho does not. Others do not. As a general, I have been trained to watch and evaluate the currents of battle. This one, the one Director Cho is fighting, is a losing one.
Do you think the director loves China any less than you? Less than any of us?
Lei asked.
No, but he is a jealous lover.
A violent one. General Tom Lee smiled self-consciously. He walked over to the Prime Minister and put his cigarette in the ashtray.
I will say nothing more.
The Foreign Minister threw up his hand in disgust. Then he excused himself and left the room. The Prime Minister rose.
General, I don't care whether you and Director Cho claw each other to pieces,
he said.
I am, however, very concerned about the launch of the Red Eagle on Thursday. Your command will use it to link communications that are currently using landlines.
That is a piggyback function,
Tom Lee replied.
One of many, yes,
Lei said.
That is why the Ministry of Science turned to a foreign firm to build the mainframe. Their design allowed us to plug in multiple utilities to consolidate what would have been several launches into one. I am concerned that your conflict with Director Cho may affect that launch.
I don't see how I can help you,
Tom Lee said.
We have a strong philosophical difference.
Yes, and it has taken physical form. The satellite is bigger than your dispute,
Lei said angrily.
Do you know what our argument is about?
You sell people,
Lei said.
At least that is what I am told.
It is not true, Mr. Prime Minister. I collect an honorarium for advice, for helping other men conduct trade.
Slave trade.
Not to me and not to them,
Tom Lee said.
These are people who want to leave China, people who do not want to be a part of Director Cho's world. Like me, they want to make more money. Unlike me, they leave. I collect my legal fee for the same reason that my soldiers gamble or occasionally traffic black market goods. Because we do not make enough money to raise and educate our families. In Russia, men in my position are selling outdated weapons. In the United States, some men sell military secrets. China benefits from both because our government is willing to pay them. We who offer our lives in the defense of our nation must make do with what the government has left, which is not very much.
Soldiers are always underpaid,
Lei said.
Their salary may not be substantial, but it is regular. They are never hungry, and they always receive medical attention.
Until new technologies reduce our numbers,
the general said.
You know as well as I that even exotic hardware like the Red Eagle is going to reduce the need for communications units. In my lifetime, I may become redundant. I do not farm. I do not weave. I will not beg to give Japanese and American visitors a tour of the Great Wall. You may not like it, and Director Cho absolutely does not like it, but I stand for many, and I will not back down. Tell me, Mr. Prime Minister, are you asking me to do so because I happen to be the last one here, or do you agree with Director Cho?
I cannot sanction what you do, but I do not support Cho's actions.
You won't tell him that, though, because he represents the party, and the party is the embodiment of Mao,
the general said.
To challenge him is to challenge the great revolutionary.
Lei said nothing.
Then I suppose I stand for you as well,
Tom Lee said.
I will resist the assault of Director Cho Xin, because his China belongs to another century. We evolve, Mr. Prime Minister. We always have. With our diversity of people and cultures and even climates, we have no choice. If we don't, we will fracture.
Tom Lee left. Lei went back to his office. He looked out the window at the soft arrival of dawn. He did not know what he had accomplished by bringing everyone together, other than to confirm what the two men were thinking, feeling, and in some cases doing. His desire to separate them and then reason with the one he hoped was the more tractable had not worked. Tom Lee was a closet capitalist, someone who still performed his job, and was a danger to no one who did not get in his way. Cho was an idealist, someone with the means and allies to attack anyone who did not share his vision. That could include the Prime Minister. It could include a scientific project that enriched foreign corporations. But the night was not a complete loss. Lei had realized something. His problem might be bigger than he imagined. General Tom Lee stood to lose something too with the successful launch of the Red Eagle. What the PLA gained in efficiency, it surrendered in manpower. And as Tom Lee had suggested, a general without troops is not a general. He is a retiree. Tom Lee and Cho Xin both had something to gain by the destruction of the satellite. Unfortunately, this was also true. If either of them won, Lei Kuan Po lost. Washington, D.C., Monday, 7 p.m. Paul Hood was baffled by the president's comments about Marines being seconded to Op Center. For one thing, the ambassador would have told the president if he had requested additional security for the embassy. For another, that was an expansion of the NCMC, not a scaling down. Perhaps it represented a honeymoon period for General Carey, a chance to let her reorganize according to her own vision. Hood hoped to find out more by seeing her. He called before leaving the White House. Bugs Benet had been happy to schedule the appointment. The drive to Op Center was both familiar and strange. Hood knew the roads, the nuances of the traffic, the sights along the way. But now he was going to a house that was no longer his home. Upon reaching Andrews Air Force Base, Hood had to stop at the security gate and let the guard check his name on the computer list. The identity card that was still in his wallet would no longer open the gate automatically. Hood parked and entered the upper lobby. The guard knew him, but still had to call ahead to let Bugs know that Hood was there. Hood was handed a pass that would work the elevator for just one day. Bugs met him downstairs. The men shook hands. Each man asked how the other was doing. But there was something guarded and unnatural about their responses. It was damned awkward. Employees were surprised to see their former boss. There were joyless smiles and a few big hellos, but no one stopped to talk. Hood was shown to what used to be his office. It looked different. It smelled different. He did not even have time to thank Bugs before he was shut inside with the general. She stood and shook his hand across the desk. The general gestured to one of the armchairs. He sat after she did. "I imagine this is a little strange for you," the general said.
"Somewhat."
"Bugs said that the president asked you to come in and talk with me," she said with a little half-smile.
"I am here because I am about to leave for Beijing. Both Bob Herbert and Mike Rogers are concerned about the launch of the Unexus satellite. The president is more concerned about the stability of the government. He wants me to assess the situation."
"It is a dangerous one," Carey said.
"Was G2 watching any of the players?"
"We collected whatever we could on all the major military and intelligence figures," she replied.
"Does anyone stand out?"
"Several." Carey picked up the phone. She tapped the intercom button. "Send them in," the general said. The door opened behind Hood, and Bob Herbert wheeled in. He was followed by Darryl McCaskey. The men shook hands. Herbert's smile was tight, his eyes bloodshot. McCaskey also looked a little drawn as he dropped into the other armchair. "I asked Bob and Darryl to join us," Carey said. "I thought it might be useful if we were all on the same page." The general looked at the men. "Paul is going to Beijing at the request of the president," Carey told Herbert and McCaskey. "President Debenport asked him to stop here first. Paul was about to tell me what information he needed."
"Actually, I'm here to find out why a contingent of Marines is being dispatched to the embassy under the auspices of Op Center," Hood said.
Carey seemed surprised by the question.
"They are going to gather intel," she replied.
"In Beijing?" Hood asked.
"In Beijing and elsewhere," the general told him. "They're all of Chinese-American heritage. G2 has been training them for years to infiltrate Chinese society, get jobs in and around the seats of government. Individuals who are not local with variable allegiance that could compromise missions, the integrity of intelligence, and the safety of other operatives."
She regarded Hood suspiciously. "The Joint Chiefs were aware of that. The president could have asked them."
"I suppose he could have, but he asked me," Hood replied innocently.
"It would be unfortunate if the president did not trust his own advisors," she said incredulously.
"I've been a White House crisis manager for less than 12 hours. I cannot say who President Debenport does or does not trust," Hood replied. "Surely we have larger issues to deal with," McCaskey said.
The FBI liaison was correct. Hood and Carey locked eyes. He was not sure how he got into yet another conflict with a woman he did not know, but here he was. And here she was. Now they had to see it through.
"Getting back on topic so I don't miss my flight, will the Marines be reporting to G2 or to Op Center?" Hood asked.
"Op Center is chartered to run military and paramilitary operations," Carey replied carefully. "G2 is not. As you know, the funding for Stryker was rolled back, but not the commission itself."
"They'll have to report directly to you," Hood said.
"Of course," she replied.
I'm the only military officer on staff. What the president obviously feared became clearer, that G2 would strip Mine Op Center for use in its own operations. That would shift the control of intelligence from the federal sector to the military. Unfortunately, Hood was forced to put all of that aside for the moment. There was still a crisis bubbling abroad.
Will I have access to your team when I'm in Beijing? Hood asked.
They have several targets, Carrie said. What are yours?
I won't know until I get there.
That would be the time to discuss it, then. You will, of course, have whatever support and cooperation I can provide, as I'm sure our team can count on yours.
Naturally.
Bob tells me that General Rogers hoped you could tap into resources the Prime Minister may have, Carrie said. He assumed correctly the President would have better access.
That is true.
You'll make a connection through our ambassador?
That's the plan, Hood said.
We still don't know why the Prime Minister is suddenly worried about the launch, McCaskey said.
Or even if he is, Herbert added. In a politically tense situation, keeping the Guoanbu out of the loop on a major project may be the Prime Minister's way of putting them in their place.
Like the Joint Chiefs or G2 not giving the President the full story about a Marine group seconded to Op Center, Hood thought. Well, I suggest we talk again when you get to Beijing, Carrie said. We'll have a better idea then about how the various scenarios might play out. Bob, do you want to be point man on that?
Sure, he said.
Very good. Carrie rose. McCaskey did as well. The general shook Hood's hand across the desk. Have a safe and productive trip, she said.
Thank you.
Ditto, McCaskey said, offering his hand.
Yeah, good luck, Herbert added. I'll see you out.
The two men left together and moved along the narrow corridor toward the elevator.
Paul, you know I'll do what I can to get those Marines if you need them, Herbert said.
I know you will, Hood replied. That's why I want you to watch your ass.
What do you mean?
I think the general knows it too, Hood said.
Beijing, China. Tuesday, 8:11 a.m. General Tom Lee was gratified when he left the Prime Minister's office. Lei Kuan Po was effective at keeping a balance between the old guard and the new without disturbing or affecting either. That was why the struggle between himself and Cho would continue a little longer. Just long enough to give the general what he really wanted. It had nothing to do with the small profit he made from the slave trade. That was a laboratory. That was how he learned who he could trust and who he could not. The real profit was in doing what men like Tom Lee did best, fighting. The general went from the Prime Minister's office to his car and drove to the small apartment he kept in the city. Attached to the Beijing Military Base Joint Command, and serving a second 4-year term as a vice chairman of the powerful Central Military Committee, the general spent half his time in the city and half his time in the field. He got back as the sun was coming up and went into his small office off his bedroom. The walls were painted white, and there were no pictures. The desk was bare, save for the radio, telephone, and the computer. Tom Lee was not a hoarder. He was not sentimental. His vision was external, about the future. He lit a cigarette, sat back in the desk chair, and contemplated the future as he listened to Beijing People's News, a round-the-clock station of international events. They were still talking about the killing of the two policemen in Taiwan. Tom Lee could not prove that Cho Shin was behind the assaults. Not that proof was required. The men had been adversaries for over 20 years, ever since they met at the Tianjin military base. As the men rose through their respective services, their mistrust and finally hatred also grew. Cho watched Tom Lee, and Tom Lee did everything he could to put false leads under the intelligence officer's nose. This time, however, Cho Shin had tried a different approach. Instead of trying to attach evidence of wrongdoing on Tom Lee, he destroyed the offending target altogether. He had struck back with his own reserve plan, the blast in Durban. Cho Shin had retaliated in Taipei. He was trying to show the general that he would not only match his actions, but surpass them. Unfortunately, while the Guoanbu director had demonstrated determination, he had not shown sufficient insight. What Tom Lee had told the Prime Minister was true. Soldiers were not paid enough for the work they did. But for Tom Lee, the transportation of indentured women was only a profitable hobby. The real work was being done in a way that Cho and the Prime Minister would not see.
until it was too late. While Cho Shin chased prostitutes and slave traders, the general had the real prize tucked somewhere else, somewhere Cho Shin and Lei Kuan Po would never think to look. Arlington, Virginia, Tuesday, 8:12 a.m. The night before, Paul Hood had called Bob Herbert about the meeting in General Carey's office. Herbert had then called Mike Rogers and asked if they could meet the next morning for breakfast. Herbert chose a diner that had ample handicap parking for his large custom-built van. The intelligence chief required two spaces for the pig, as he called it. Rogers was already there, sitting in a corner booth and reading the newspaper. The intelligence chief sat at the end of the table in the aisle.
I appreciate this, Mike, Herbert said.
Sure.
Do I look as crappy as I feel?
Pretty much,
Rogers replied.
What's wrong? The new boss or the old one?
Both, Herbert laughed.
Crunched in the middle of a sudden transition?
That's not it, Herbert said.
The waitress came and the men ordered. When she left, the intelligence chief hunched forward.
Paul thinks there may be a power shift taking place. He's concerned that the sudden appointment of General Carey to Op Center may be a harbinger of a military takeover of national intelligence.
That's a pretty big leap.
That's what I thought, Herbert said.
Anyway, he's the guy close to the president, and the president is the one who made the appointment.
Under pressure from the Joint Chiefs, apparently, Herbert said.
Rogers shrugged.
Compromises happen. That doesn't necessarily mean a seismic shift.
No, but as I was thinking about it last night, there was one thing that bothered me.
Herbert leaned even closer.
Davenport was the head of the CIOC. He was getting ready to run for president at the time. If he thought this was something he wanted to do, why did he put your name on top of the downsize list?
Maybe Senator Davenport wanted to clear the path for a woman,
Rogers said.
General Carey may have been on his radar as the most qualified individual. If he had just kicked me out and put her in, that might have been perceived as reverse discrimination. A lot of members of Congress and the military would not have approved, and Carey would not have enjoyed the legitimacy that position demands.
Possible, although you credit Davenport with more forethought than I do, Herbert said.
He glanced around casually, then spoke in a voice barely more than a whisper.
She's also got Stryker back.
What?
She's sending 4 Asian-American Marines to Beijing undercover through the embassy.
For covert or intel activity?
The latter, Herbert said.
We had people who could have done that.
Exactly. 2 well-trained Asian-Americans from your field staff. They weren't even contacted.
Has Carey worked with these Marines before?
Until yesterday morning, she was crunching data at G2, Herbert said.
I see.
Their food arrived. Herbert was silent until the waitress was through.
Maybe this is just a realignment, he went on. Maybe there are too many civilians in the intel business. The Joint Chiefs complain, the president capitulates. But if it was just about equilibrium, why would he create a new post for Paul? One that keeps him very close, unless it was to keep an eye on the brass intel expansion.
You mean the president would have just put him out to graze, as he did with me,
Rogers said.
What does your gut tell you?
Herbert pressed.
My instincts say there's something to Paul's concerns,
Rogers said.
So what do we do?
Herbert asked.
Paul and me, he added.
This was not Mike Rogers' problem, and he recognized that.
There is one way we might find out more,
Rogers said.
What's that?
It's been suggested that I go over for the launch. I think I will.
Why were you undecided? It's your satellite.
That's why,
Rogers said.
As you know, there are elements of the Chinese government who do not want to be reminded of that.
Paul's going over. He's probably already en route.
Right. If I go, I might be able to help keep an eye on the Marines, especially if they go to the Xichang Space Center.
Apart from ticking off some of the Chinese, is there a downside for you?
Herbert asked.
Only if the rocket blows up,
he said, as he took a bite of melon. Washington, D.C., Tuesday, 8:48 a.m. The idea of bringing Marines into play was General Carey's. It was enthusiastically endorsed by Joint Chiefs Chairman General Raleigh Carew. He said that one of the failures of Op Center had been the difficulty Hood, Rogers, and Herbert had in attracting human intelligence operatives in foreign lands. There were the historic problems, fear of repercussions among potential spies, and difficulty trusting even those who agreed to help. The answer, Carew believed, was sending what the intelligence community called passables, outsiders who could blend in with the local population, and were quick studies on customs, fads, and colloquialisms not covered in their training. They were designed to serve as both spectar units, staying long enough to hit specific targets and then leaving, and as sleeper cells. General Carey arrived at Hangar 5 at Andrews Air Force Base. The four Marines were dressed in civvies and sitting on folding chairs in the center of a ready room. The three men and one woman had been driven over from Quantico, where they had trained. After Carey had spoken with them, they would be taken to Dulles for a flight to Tokyo. There, they would transfer for the trip to Beijing. The Marines got to their feet and saluted when the general entered. Carey returned the salute and told them to sit back down. They were all in their early 20s, but had eyes that were much, much older. Before coming over, she had studied their records, both their real dossiers and the identities G2 had given them. In everyday Chinese life, the Marines would be posing as two history students, a bicycle repairman, and an electronics technician. "Does anyone have any questions, any last-minute requests or ideas?" General Carey asked. "No, sir," they all replied. "Just a few spot checks for my own peace of mind," the general said. "You've all got your cover stories, as well as the scientific credentials lined up to get into the launch site if that should be necessary?" "The papers and passes have already been delivered to the embassy," said one of the men. "A female diplomat will make the delivery tomorrow at noon at a popular dumpling stall. She will make a pass at me, and we'll do the switch." "Tough job," the general said with a smile. "You have all got your exit strategies, if that becomes necessary?" "We fall back to the embassy or to the safe house near the Beijing Zoo," one of the Marines said. "And you've all studied the Space Center if you're asked to go there?" the general asked. "We've gone through it in virtual sims, general," the woman said. "We know that place better than we know our own barracks." There was no time to chat further, nor any need. Carrie had seen all she needed to see. They were four sharp, enthusiastic Marines. She wished them well and saluted them proudly. Zhuhai, China, Wednesday, 11 a.m. Though General Tom Lee held all his bases in high regard, he preferred the facility to which he was headed now. The Zhuhai base was the home of the PLA's Macau forces, key players in his master plan. Macau was only 6 square miles, a narrow peninsula connected to the mainland by an even narrower isthmus. It was the oldest European settlement in China, and had been administered by Portugal since 1557. Yet most of the inhabitants were Chinese, and the hilly, rocky peninsula adjoined the Guangdong province in southeastern China. Tom Lee wanted it for China, and one day he would have it. But first, his larger objective must be realized. The general traveled to Zhuhai on board a Gazelle helicopter gunship. The trip from Beijing took a little over 3 hours, with a quick refueling stop. The general was at his desk by 9:30 for the 11 o'clock meeting. The other 7 members of the Central Military Committee arrived at different hours throughout the morning. The generals and admirals had come from Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, and other cities across the nation. They came separately and discreetly by air. This was not one of the committee's regular monthly meetings, and the men did not want to attract attention by gathering in Beijing or traveling together. Besides, the way Cho Shin was attacking Tom Lee's interests, the officers did not want to be out and about with him. None of them put it past the Guoanbu to assassinate the general, especially if Cho found out what Tom Lee was planning. The irony, Tom Lee knew, was that Cho would probably approve of the plan, but for one thing. It would shift the balance of influence in Beijing from the old-line communists to the more capitalistic-minded military. That was something Cho Shin would never permit. The officers had all assembled by 11. They gathered in the small tactics room down the hall from Tom Lee's office. Tom Lee sat at the large round table in the center of the windowless chamber. Each of the men had brought folders containing different aspects of the plan. If any one of these files had been lost or confiscated, it would make no sense. All of them were required for the plan to be clear.
"Has there been any change in the Guoanbu plan for the launch?"
Tom Lee asked as he sat down. The general's question had been addressed to Rear Admiral Lung Ti. The 53-year-old officer ran the 3rd Department of the People's Liberation Navy, which was in charge of naval intelligence. The division was linked closely to activities in the other intelligence agencies. It was an alert from the Rear Admiral that had triggered this plan 3 months before.
"There is no change," Lung Ti replied. "Even if we did not have whispers from inside the Guoanbu, a man like Director Cho does not undertake a project unless he is sure of his mission."
"He is very sure," Tom Lee agreed.
"I was just with him. When the Prime Minister learned of the explosion, he called us to his office. Lee Kuan Po showed uncharacteristic displeasure as he pressed us both for an explanation. Cho gave none and left the meeting before it was ended."
"Did Cho mention the satellite launch?" Lung Ti asked.
Tom Lee shook his head once.
"He spoke about a singular vision for China and refused to condemn the attacks on my private market economy. That was the extent of his contribution."
"Was Cho feeling any pressure at all?" asked the Rear Admiral.
"No. He was angry to be there, to have his motives questioned," Tom Lee replied.
"That would suggest a crisis point is very near," said the Rear Admiral. "What a waste of effort," another man said.
"It is a counterproductive effort,"
Tom Lee said sadly.
"Do you remember Cho's last contribution to our economy? He made the deal to sell tens of thousands of machetes to Hutu killers in Rwanda during the 100 days of slaughter."
"Now he's killing again," one of the generals remarked.
"That is how communists move the economy."
The general's comment was a simplification, but it was true. Cho refused to fully embrace capitalistic solutions. He saw increasing numbers of beggars in the streets and opposed allowing more foreign corporations in to hire them. He knew that foreign banks and corporations were assuming Chinese debt in exchange for more and more collateral properties. Yet his wish was to maintain the system that allowed these things to flourish.
"I say once again that we should put a bullet in the back of his neck and move on," Lung Ti said.
"A bullet won't get us everything we want," Tom Lee reminded him.
"You do not believe Lee Kuan Po will try to stop Cho?" Lung Ti asked.
"I do not believe he will,"
Tom Lee said.
"We proceed with our own plans, but I will have my own security people on alert in case Cho gets in our way. We will follow his staff and learn who his contacts and workers are. We will use them ourselves."
Tom Lee looked at the Rear Admiral as he spoke. It was Lung Ti's intelligence that had suggested there would be assaults in Charleston and in Taipei as a prelude to an attack on the rocket. His people had become aware of the comings and goings of explosives experts from safe houses in the United States and Taiwan. That had been the first indication of fresh initiatives, as aggressive new intelligence actions were called. Once the individuals were flagged, the PLN-3 watched them. There were requests for detailed maps, which went through a central logistics center, and travel documents. There was one other site on that list, the Xichang Space Center.
"We do not have a lot of time before the launch," Tom Lee went on. "I want to make certain that our operations are coordinated."
He proceeded to review the PLA response, codenamed Sovereign Dragon. 24 hours before the launch, Taiwan would put its military on alert. Any Chinese rocket launch was an excuse to scramble Taiwanese air and sea forces. Taipei would say the launch could be an act of aggression, a potential intercontinental missile strike. Typically, launches like these were a chance for the nationalists to strut their muscle without fear of reprisal. Typically. But not this time. Throughout their career, these 7 veterans had watched the Chinese military become Shangxie, more and more of less and less. Though the PLA received budget increases, that money went to updating hardware in an attempt to gain parity with foreign forces. By that time, the enemy had advanced even further. China would always be behind in everything except manpower. That would be used for the backbone of Sovereign Dragon. Unfortunately, there were very few barriers to which that manpower could be effectively supplied. Over the past 20 years, China had become increasingly isolated and marginalized militarily. To the north, they were bordered by slumbering but still dangerous Russia. To the east was Japan,
which was on the verge of deploying a $10 billion missile shield in conjunction with the United States. Nearer to home were an increasingly Western-leaning Vietnam and the smoldering Koreas. To the south and west were India and Pakistan, whose Hindu and Islamic rivalry could become a nuclear showdown at any time. If China did not make a move soon, there would be no moves to make. The job of the PLA would become purely defensive, to keep other wars and nations out, not to enhance China's international standing or power base. Without those, China would become what it was during the Boxer Rebellion, a carcass to be picked at by foreign powers. To Cho and his people, that was acceptable. Closing the doors and keeping the communist vision pure was a victory. To Tom Lee and his allies, that was an unacceptable loss of face, as well as a slow death. So they went over their plans and timetables, fine-tuned the specifics. They would begin with a response to the Taiwanese action. The PLN deployment would be modest and not unprecedented. But this time, things would be different. Taiwan would be accused of capitalizing on a tragedy that was about to befall the PRC. As a result, the deployment of PLA Navy ships would be followed by the launching of PLA Air Force squadrons over the Taiwan Strait. While the world watched the buildup there, the PLA would seek and obtain the authority to establish buffer zones inside the current borders of Laos, Vietnam, and Burma to prevent opportunistic actions by those governments against coveted Chinese lands. The Central Military Committee would be granted those powers because they feared other terrorist actions, like the one that was about to take down the Xichang rocket. While all of this was happening, Taiwan would be blockaded. The United States would be told that an attack on the PLA would be met with devastating force. If they chose to move against China, China would invade the bordering states. Not even India could withstand an invasion of that magnitude. Either the United States had to accept a reintegrated Taiwan or face a massive war on many fronts. They would press for, then accept, a negotiated settlement that joined a healthy capitalistic society with a dormant giant. The symbiosis would allow both to grow exponentially. And in a very few years, China would be the greatest power the world had ever known. General Tom Lee wondered how Cho Shin would react to the sudden, wrenching change in Chinese society. How could anyone react negatively to their nation going from a third-world economy to one of the most viable on Earth? The PLA and the rest of China were about to find out. And then Tom Lee would make certain of something else: that Cho Shin was arrested and executed for treason.